for today?
Okay, a quorum is present.
I think we pass it on, right?
Good chance to pass it on.
The Committee on Local Government and Elections will come to order. First of all, we have a new member, Senator McGuire. If you'd like to introduce yourself, feel free.
Thank you.
Speeches thank are, you. Have to, introductory speeches are less than 30 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm excited to be here on this committee. I'm Mary Jo McGuire. I represent City of Falcon Heights and St. Paul in the communities and neighborhoods of St. Anthony Park, Como Park, Midway, and East St. Paul, and I'm excited to be here.
Well,
look forward
you.
To working with all of you.
We're glad to have you here. So, thank you. And it's also Senator Cruz's birthday, so
aww.
If anyone yay. Wants to sing her, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
And then, with that,
I'll use this.
The first bill on today's agenda is Senate File 1190. Senator Chamberlain moves that Senate File 1190 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. Senator Chamberlain, to your bill.
If it would be okay with you, we have an amendment, author's amendment. It's A1. But he's got it. This is just a little extra language is going to go on page 2 of the bill.
So Senator Chamberlain moves the A1 amendment. This is to put the bill in the shape you'd like it in. Discussion to the A1 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Senator Chamberlain, to your bill.
Bill was brought to my attention not long ago, maybe a week ago. And it's been an issue that's been out there for a few years. I've had some reports on it a couple of years ago. The legislature established a committee, another committee, a commission to study this issue of vacation rental homes, particularly what it is. Homeowners, private homes, single-family, multi-family units, condos, and single homes, where people will rent those homes and those residences out for a vacation for a week or days or a month or 2 months at a time. It came to the attention of the Department of Health that this activity was going on out there. They did some research. That was part of the work they did a couple of years ago as well. And they sent out some letters. And what we're trying to do is this is a jobs bill as well. Everything's jobs bill. If the Department of Health comes in and starts regulating these private homes, and these private rentals in most cases, it's going to do a lot of harm to local communities, local trades, tourism. That's very vital to a lot of these smaller communities. So what we're trying to do is reach a compromise with local communities, towns, cities, and counties, so they still have the authority to oversee these rentals when they need to be over, when they need the oversight, but giving the property owners their due rights and ability to exercise, rent out their own homes, their own property for some extra money. So with that, I will turn it over to, I think, Mr. McGrath. You want
John Swanson.
John, you want to testify first?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, bear with me if I don't hold the proper decorum. This is my first time.
Sure. Could you say your name and?
My name is John Swanson.
In your position.
I'm from Ely, Minnesota, and I'm the current president of the Minnesota Vacation Rental Association, and I also am a property manager. I have a broker's license, and I have a business in Ely, Minnesota, and I manage about 55 properties. And along with that, I also have a resort in Ely, Minnesota.
Thank you. Continue. Go ahead.
Yeah. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to have an opportunity to voice my opinion. My biggest concern, and most of my members' concern, is twofold. One is that that we are licensed, and we are licensed properly, and we're licensed in such a way that it does protect the public safety, but it still allows us to function as a private home rental. So we like that to be reasonable, but we do agree with the fact that it should be done. And secondly, our biggest concern is with the zoning. And the zoning as it stands, and it varies all across the state, we can very easily be put out of business, 80-90% of us, if we are called a task and have to go before the local boards, and they're going to require a conditional use permit or a interim permit of some kind, and we're concerned that that could eliminate maybe 80-90% of our rentals based on existing zoning and the language in some of the local localities. In Ely, as an example, Ely private home rentals represent about 15-20% of the total lodging dollars that pass through the community. These dollars multiply about 6 or 7 times as they pass through the community, depending on what study that you would use. These numbers may be conservative because a lot of this business is under the radar, and it's hard to get a handle on exactly how many there are. But our best guess in Ely, it is about 15-20%. If we would lose this would have a devastating impact on our local merchants and could affect the local government budget also. Using myself as an example, I employ about 50 people in a season, and if I lost my ability and lost my vacation rentals, I would be laying off about 25 people, and of course I'd be closing my business. I would lose my business. I currently manage about 55 units. I have some clients with some very nice properties, but I don't have any rich clients. The people that ask for my services really need the income from the rentals. A couple profiles would be a husband and wife had bought the, finally had the saved up enough money and bought themselves a vacation home sometime prior, probably to 2006 or 7, before things went south on us from property values. And last year, the husband or wife lost their job or got downsized dramatically. They can't afford to make the payment on their home, on their vacation home. Unfortunately, they can't put it on the market. Well, they could, but it won't sell. We cannot, at this current time, sell vacation properties, lakeshore properties, in Ely, Minnesota. They're just not turning over well. We sold probably 6 in the last couple of years. So they're faced with a dilemma of losing it to the bank or to come to a person like myself or doing it themselves to put it on the market and rent it for the income to support the property. Another example of a profile would be a son or a daughter, their father passed away and left the property to them. It's been a family for 75, 80, 100 years. And they suddenly find themselves with an expense they can't afford. They've also maybe been downsized or they got 2 kids heading for college or whatever the case might be. They can't afford it. The non-homesteaded taxes and other expenses that come with the ownership of the home, of the property. And they don't want to sell it, and they probably couldn't if they would, but if they, so consequently, to keep it in the family, they come to a person like myself, or they do it themselves, and they rent it to, they put it on the market for rental. And it's strictly to produce income, right, in order to support their property and be able to retain it. The private home rentals has pretty much been under the radar a lot, but lately it's been growing, dramatically over the past 2 or 3 years for a variety of reasons, not only in our Ely area, but in other spots in the nation. There's more and more people that are either renting their homes based on demand or need, or there's more and more people that want to rent homes as their type of experience on vacation.
So, Mr. Swenson, do you feel the typical person that utilizes a vacation rental is someone who wouldn't be going to your area if those weren't available, as opposed, or would they go to a Or do you think you're in direct competition with hotels?
My experience with that, because I do both, and we answer both my resort businesses and my property that are being managed come through the same switchboard, the same desk. And I would say there's some crossover, but about I would easily say 90% of the people that stay in private homes, that's the experience that they want. They want that privacy and the intimacy of a private home. They don't want the organized activities of a resort. And generally, they get more bang for the buck. So there's very little crossover between the resorts and private homes. I wish there was more, because when I don't have the private home to fit their need, I cannot get them into a resort, and consequently, these type of people will go to another area. They will go to Brainerd or another state even.
Sorry. Okay, Senator Peterson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, he just answered it. That was my question, is that what's the difference in the user? Because this seems like two distinct markets to me, and that was my question. I think he just answered, is that the folks renting single-family homes are looking for a different environment
than
a resort. Is that,
yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Swenson? Senator Kaler.
Mr. Swenson, you have both resort and rental units. What percentage of your business is resort, and which is rental units?
Yeah, I have about 55 private homes okay. currently. And I have my resort has 14 cabins.
Okay.
And now I do have two other resorts that I also manage through there, but that they're not part of the 55. So I did have three resorts as of last year, and I sold two of them off. So I did have up to 40 resort cabins at one time.
Okay, so there's a bigger percentage.
Right now it's a bigger percentage of my business.
Yeah. One of my concerns, now you're operating as a broker of these vacation rental properties. Who is regulating or monitoring the quality of the places, whether or not the septic systems can handle year-round use, et cetera? I know that there's been, I sit on the environmental committee, there's been a lot of issues about straight pipe systems, and also systems that just have a settling with no settling tank with no drain field. Is there a way of rating these things somehow or other?
Well, I'd like to think there will be in the future. Currently, we do ourselves. We self-regulate. I hold the private homes that I manage to the same standard as my resort cabins. And that includes both water quality and septic, and other safety issues such as fire and smoke alarms and so on and so on. So I do hold my private homes. They have to, if they don't meet the same standard as my resort cabins do, then they either have to change or we don't manage them, because I don't want the liability.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bill Griffith, representing the association. Also, the private homes are regulated under local law for their septic systems and their water systems, and so that doesn't change by virtue of the fact that they're rented by people under private contract. So any regulation that applies today to a single-family home would apply to a vacation rental. The inspection programs, the licensing programs for septic systems.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Chamberlain, I'm not sure who would answer this question, but my assumption is if there's a disagreement between the owner or the broker and the person renting the cabin, and my guess is they just don't pay the bill. If there's some type of dispute with the property and that type of thing, you know, if something goes wrong in terms of how they think the facility is operating, or I think that others are looking to regulate, can you give us a sense of what happens between the customer and the broker and the owner of the property if there's a disagreement?
Mr. Swanson?
Yes, sir. We have a contract with all our clients, and it's a contract that's written in such a way that it really holds my feet to the fire because I think that's more appropriate. It's there to protect my client and the and their customers, which are my customers indirectly. So contractually, I have to live up to a certain standard, and all those concerns you had are within that contract.
Thanks.
Any other additional testifiers, Mr. Senator Chamberlain?
Chris Alaric from Ely, Minnesota. And we purchased a lake home back about 6-7 years ago. Young family, we were out there every weekend, enjoyed it, went out Friday night, came home Sunday. And a few years later, we ended up buying a resort in Ely. And so we could no longer use our place. And I'm in the real estate, I'm a real estate broker as well. Was not able to sell the place, you know, that wasn't an option in this market. And so we put money in the building, remodeling the place, bringing it up to code, getting everything ready so we could rent it. That was an option that, you know, as a real estate broker, that's one of our options in this state. It's the right to rent our property. And after doing that, then we've been running into some roadblocks from people at different levels, chamber, county, townships, telling us that we couldn't anymore, or trying to make it more difficult. And so that is what led me to be here today and be part of the Minnesota Vacation Rental Association, is to try and protect my right to continue to rent our property. And that's why I'm here today. So thank you for hearing me.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kalish.
Well, I was just going to, Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask if you could be more specific about the kinds of roadblocks and which agencies are and for what reasons?
From a chamber level, the chamber board, that's a very minimal level, but the chamber was people on the board are trying to prevent vacation rentals in Ely, just as a not allowed use. Did get the letter from the Department of Health stating that I could not rent. They said I was a hotel motel and I could not rent for less than a week. What were some of the Lake County? We're on the border of St. Louis County and Lake County. St. Louis County is go for it, letting the state take care of it. Lake County has put a 2-year moratorium in Lake County that says absolute no rentals, no more. For the past 2 years, we've done no rent, no vacation rental in Lake County. So it's just every level we're fighting it seems like.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll be brief. I'm Bill Griffith, representing the association. And testimony that you've heard is the reason that this bill is important and necessary. We do not have any problem at all as an association with reasonable local licensing and regulation. In fact, we think it would be good to have a level playing field in that regard. But because of the differing treatment all over the state, we find it necessary to clarify in zoning law that this is an allowed use of residential property. And you heard the testimony about the contract, the private contract between an owner and a vacation renter. And that's exactly what it is, and it distinguishes it from public lodging. Public lodging, you can drive up to the facility, you can knock on the door, and they have to make a public accommodation available on the same basis to the public. This is a private rental of your home, and it allows in many cases for people to hang on to their homes or their second homes. I'm going to give you two quick examples of why this bill is so necessary. Just recently, the Scott County District Court threw out a case in which Scott County prosecuted a woman criminally for renting her home. They treated her as a criminal and as a crime for renting her home to try and make a little extra money on a short-term basis. So that's an example of a very aggressive move by a county prosecutor to criminalize this activity. Second, about 2 months ago, I had a woman from northwestern Minnesota call me as someone who understands these issues legally and say, can you help me? The county is saying that I have to treat my private swimming pool in my second home as a public pool. I have to basically convert that to a public pool or fill it in or I can't rent my home. Now, this woman was already in distress because she lost her primary residence. She was renting and she was trying to hang on to her second residence, something that had been in her family for a long time. Because it happened to have a private pool, she was being treated, again, as public lodging. These are the kinds of things that we're trying to address with a very simple bill. It says two things. It says this is an allowed use in residential for residential property, and the one exception to that permission, basically, is that the local authorities can choose to license it or, as the author's amendment would suggest, register the property, either or. We think it's a very simple and straightforward approach. We've tried to consider the concerns that we've heard over the last couple of years, and we're open to those. The last point that I will make is it doesn't change any of the public authorities, the local units' ability to regulate nuisances, to regulate trash, to regulate egress, to regulate all sorts of issues that they currently regulate under public health, safety, and welfare laws. We do not intend to affect that. We simply want to say that this is an allowed use of residential property, to rent your property on a short-term basis. So that's the essence of the bill, and we thank you for hearing it today.
Thank you. Senator Kalish. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Griffin, what concerns me is that the right of the property owner is a great point that you make, but what about the neighbors to that property? They went into an agreement when they purchased their home that they were in a residential neighborhood, not in a area where the properties are continually being rented, not knowing who's going to be there from 1 week to the next, etc. And it seems to me that one of the things that bothers me about this is it's kind of all-encompassing. It says all the properties are eligible for rent, and the county can't say if it's zoned in this particular area that you cannot rent that property because it's not zoned for any rental. Is there some place in the middle? Am I getting that wrong, number one? Is there some place in the middle that can reach both concerns?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, sure. Members, thank you for the question, Senator. I think that's essentially the nub of the issue is we have a constitutional right, any one of us, as owners, to rent our property and free from local government interference. Any local government that thinks that they can tell me that I can't rent my property, I think they have a constitutional problem. But having said that, Senator, we are open to licensing. We're open to regulation. Nuisance law, if I do something in my home that affects my neighbor, there are existing nuisance laws that you can avail yourself of and the prosecutors can avail themselves of. So all of that is still in place. That regulatory regime is still in place. But the fundamental proposition that I can rent my home, whether it's short-term or long-term, is protected by this bill and, frankly, protected by the Constitution. So we are not afraid at all to engage with the League of Minnesota Cities on a model ordinance or the counties, any of them. We'd love to sit down with them and work on model ordinances, but we do need this protection because, as our testifiers said, there's differing treatment all over the state, including a moratorium in Lake County, one of the most desirable locations for vacation rentals. So that's really, I think there is a balance that we can strike, and we're very open to that.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I noticed you didn't mention counties or municipalities zoning against that. And, you know, if they decided they didn't want rental properties on whatever lake, that you're saying that they can't zone against that?
I don't think so. I've spent 23 years in land use and zoning, and I would say as a fundamental proposition that landowners are free to rent their homes based on reasonable regulation. So, sure, we can have regulations about egress windows and fire extinguishers and all sorts of things, but ultimately I can rent my home, and I would challenge anybody who says otherwise.
Further, anyone else want to testify for this bill? Okay, would anyone care to testify against this bill?
To testify for it.
And if you could just state your name for the record. Who would like to go first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Tom Grundhofer. I'm general counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I guess I'll take the lead here representing the sort of the local government group. With all due respect to Senator Chamberlain, we feel compelled to speak in opposition to the bill. Our opposition is based primarily on what I think is the very broad and open-ended nature of the definition of what is considered a vacation rental. Really, the bill as written essentially strips local governments of their authority to apply local land use regulations to really a whole host of potential commercial operations. And I know we've heard the testimony, I want to rent my home for a, you know, a period of time, but this really creates a whole set of commercial operations in residential districts. And let me give you a couple examples. The bill as written would allow, for instance, a developer to purchase a multifamily apartment complex and begin renting it out, sort of equivalent, sort of a hotel sort of operation, because that would be considered a multiple family residential use. And then I can rent that out for whatever purposes I see fit. That's one thing. It would permit a company to purchase a home in the middle of a city's residential neighborhood and begin renting it out on a, say, a one-day, two-day, five-day, or other short-term basis without really having to worry about any of the typical land use requirements that might be imposed on that kind of operation, such as lighting, screening, parking requirements, limitations on the number of unrelated individuals who can occupy in that area. Now, I'm not saying that's the intent, but clearly on this face, the law says that that's allowed. It clearly would allow a developer, for instance, to purchase a whole series of residential lots on a lake and turn those series of residential lots into a, in essence, into a resort without having to go through some of the typical procedures at the local level that would require land use regulation of that resort activity. It would allow, for instance, turning of a residential structure into a bed and breakfast, again, without any sort of zoning, say, one way or another with regard to that. In short, really, because of a lack of any definition, and if you look at the bill, there is no definition of what constitutes a vacation rental. The bill strips away local control that allows communities to really try to mediate the effects between residential homeowners and some of the commercial operations that might become next door. I really can appreciate the purpose of the legislation is to protect the rights of homeowners to rent their properties out on an occasional basis, but the fact is the law really goes well beyond that because of its expansive, expansive definition of vacation rentals. Really, the fact that there's no definition of vacation rentals, it pretty much creates a carte blanche opportunity for anybody to practically do anything with their home in a residential area. That's what local regulation of land use is about, and that's why we really have to oppose this. And as Senator Kielesch mentioned, it's not only protect the property rights of the homeowner, but the property rights of the adjacent individual who has to live with next to a pretty much of an unregulated use.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you can clarify for me. I'm trying to understand this issue of a local control. I mean, it seems that local control is something that we all want for our districts and our communities, and every community is different, so certainly it's much better to have that control at a local level. But all those potential problems that you described, unlimited number of unrelated adults, number of cars, all that type of thing, it just seems to me that, at least in my communities, the local control ordinances are already regulating those things. I mean, there are already all kinds of local ordinances that regulate the very problems that you were suggesting might happen, and so I'm having a hard time understanding why it is we need a state law to allow for local regulation when in reality the locals are already regulating all the things that you mentioned.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, you're absolutely right. That is the type of thing that local governments do regulate at the local level. Where they regulate it at the local level typically is through their zoning regulations. When a vacation rental, whatever that term is deemed to be at the end of the day, is deemed to be a permitted use, that you typically will impose those sorts of conditions as a item of a conditional use permit or interim use permit. These are permitted uses that have the same rights to occupy on a block that you're my house would. So it brings in a whole raft of other issues that aren't typically dealt with for permitted uses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grunheffer. I'm still puzzling about that, though, because we are allowing municipalities to license, and could not they make the conditions of licensing stricter so that there would be, you know, maybe only two or three vehicles permitted? I mean, I think it could be done through licensing, and it wouldn't have to be done through zoning laws.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I think you are accurate in that regard. Senator, there are a whole variety of communities who don't do rental licensing ordinances right now. I could probably count on about one hand the number of communities around the state that actually do rental housing ordinances. So in theory, yes, I agree with you, but it basically forces local governments to have to then go out and adopt a whole series of rental housing ordinances that would have to not only apply to these probably vacation rentals, but from an equal protection standpoint would probably have to apply to every rental activity in the community. And there's, you know, a whole variety of communities that just, you know, don't get involved in rental housing licensing. But, yes, technically you're right.
Mr. Grunheffer, I don't think you can have it both ways. So the first part of your testimony, you're retracting, or where this was taking away the ability to do all this and putting everyone in danger next to it and basically the end of the world as we know it, and now we find that you probably could still regulate and protect health and safety.
Mr. Chair, Grunheffer, there are certainly some sort of public health, safety, welfare provisions that you could put in place. The question is, could you put them in place to the extent that you could prohibit somebody from doing what they wanted with their property? And I don't think you could. This is about dealing with compatible or incompatible land uses, and I think, as you know, Senator Kelesh identified, you know, when I bought my home, I didn't anticipate my neighbor is going to be using it for ongoing daily changeover rentals.
Senator Roebling, did you have a...
Well, as a follow-up, and Mr. Grunheffer mentioned that most communities don't have rental ordinances, and I think it kind of addresses the issue that there hasn't been a lot of problems, or they would. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly they could put some in place if they feel the need or they think that there are going to be problems. And you know, as far as having people in cabins next door to yours that might be renters, I know some really large families that own cabins jointly, and every week a different family and their friends go up there, and the neighbors have no control over that either. I mean, there's all kinds of circumstances where you can have different activities and different people in those places from week to week. And, and maybe sometimes the neighbors aren't happy with what's going on over there, but then there's nuisance laws and there are other conditions in place, other statutes and ordinances that should be able to address most of those if people are getting out of hand on the adjoining property.
Mr. Chair?
And Senator Chamberlain.
As an example of these ordinances, a lot of communities may not have them, but Stearns County has a fairly extensive one that addresses how much water, how many people, how many homes. So there are things out there can be modeled to help out these other communities. So it does address all those, a lot of those health and safety issues. And this is on the books for Stearns County. And it also requires those renters to have people who own those homes and rent out to have a license. So it can be mitigated.
And I'm having a difficulty understanding this perpetual attack on renters, too. I don't know that they're all bad people, but Senator Kalish.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think one of the issues right now, we have a certain amount of monitoring, and we're doing it under the lodging rules, and I don't disagree that we should have something that allows folks to rent their homes, but I also think we have to have limitations. And I, you know, I recognize that the bill says local municipalities can set up their own regulations. And my question is, since there's so few that are actually doing it, what's the expense to the local township, county, community to both set up these regulations, monitor, and then, you know, in fact, enforce the regulations they apply, especially when you're in these townships with very limited populations? I don't know if you can address that, Mr. Grunhofer.
Obviously, Mr. Chair, members, obviously there's a cost to regulate rental housing, and frankly, most of our communities don't have the resources to head down that road right now. So the reality is that a lot of this stuff will go unregulated, at least in the near future. The one other comment I would make is, and I go back to my original point, this law just doesn't deal with you or me renting our home. There's nothing to really prohibit corporations, partnerships, otherwise in buying large parcels and basically turning them into vacation rentals, whatever that term might mean, regardless of where they happen to be located, in the middle of a residential area and an urban area. This isn't just about, and I'm not totally unsympathetic to the goal of this bill. My point, though, is as written, vacation rental is not defined and encompasses a whole variety of things that I think go well beyond the intent.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chamberlain, you don't have an enactment date on this. I was wondering if you had a timeline for when this can go forward, and if in fact we can give far enough timeline so that cities, counties, etc., can react to this if need be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, that's a good point. Look at that enactment date. We have talked about working out some definitions of a vacation home rental, residential vacation home rental, and that's fine. We can do that. Our goal with this bill is to give some immediate relief and protection, and we can certainly work on a definition prior to even final passage to the House or the Senate, off the Senate floor. But that has been discussed among some of the interested parties here.
Senator Rowland.
Mr. Chair, with no enactment date, mentioned August 1st would be the enactment date.
Senator Kielash.
I have no.
If you're okay.
Is that okay? I don't know if we can get enough of this done. I would like to. Is this going to go from here to where state government health?
Right now it's headed for general orders. Senator Chamberlain indicated he could work on something maybe between here and there for him to address it on the floor. Or
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question on page 2, line 4, and also it's in similar language on page 3. If I can direct you to line 4, vacation rental must be considered a permitted single family. So it's the intent of the author that if you had a home and you wanted to rent it out for a weekend, you have to get a permit. Is that the way I understand the permitted language?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I think I can speak for the author on this one. The term permitted is meant to, under zoning ordinances, they have uses that are permitted in certain districts and those that might be conditional use permits in certain districts. It just means those that are authorized in certain zoning district. It doesn't contemplate a special permit in any sort.
Allowable.
That's correct, Chair.
Mr. Chair, you might want to alter your language a little bit because I think it could be confusing. You might want to say for vacation rental, maybe the operative word might be to be permitted. Or something along that line, rather than when I see the word considered a permitted permitted single family, I'm thinking you need a permit from the local jurisdiction. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
Senator Limmer, I think that permitted means allowed, and mm-hmm. it's used kind of pretty consistently through the statute.
All right.
Mr. Chairman and members, as a matter of zoning law, permitted use is understood to be one that's allowed as a matter of right, subject to reasonable conditions that the government can impose, not as a conditional use permit, but as performance standards. Something like a setback would be an example of a permitted use that's subject to a condition.
Further testifiers? Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Michelle McPherson. I'm the director of the Land Services Office, County Recorder, and Registrar of Titles for Mille Lacs County. I'm here to represent both Mille Lacs County and the Association of Minnesota Counties. Mille Lacs County recently adopted an ordinance providing for interim use permits for these types of uses. I'll note that in the author's comments regarding Stearns County, in addition to their licensing requirement, they also have a interim use or conditional use permit requirement for these same types of uses. I'd like to go on record stating that Mille Lacs County is not opposed to vacation rental homes. We believe that as a tourist county, they do allow for diversity of experiences for tourism purposes. They provide increased rental stock. Many of our resorts have fallen by the wayside, been converted to other types of planned unit developments and those types of things. As Mr. Grundhofer testified, however, we are concerned regarding the must provision. I would question the ability of local residents to know that there is a rental next door to them, and what relief and how they would seek relief beyond our typical nuisance requirements. Allowing for local governments to hold public hearings and to place conditions beyond the typical parking, waste, wastewater, trash collection that is site-specific is one of those local control things that I think is important for neighborhood compatibility. The proposed rule, or excuse me, statute amendment basically places vacation rental homes similar to residential group homes. And I know that when I worked in the cities, residential group homes were often a concern of neighbors because there was no local control or local ability to regulate them to any extent. In terms of the question that I believe Senator Kielash asked about what the potential cost to counties, I can't give you a number, but I can tell you that most counties have some form of zoning administration. So from our perspective, to have them go through a zoning permit, an interim use permit, a conditional use permit, is most cost effective because we have those types of folks, staff people that are experienced who can do that as part of their everyday tasks, as opposed to the other option, which is to establish a licensing program, which would go beyond merely vacation rentals. We would have to, under equal protection, regulate all sorts of rental housing, which we currently don't do. And so from a cost perspective, it's easier for us to have that local control, issue those local interim and conditional use permits without adding staff. You'll note my title. 2 years ago, Mille Lacs County consolidated three departments, and I'm the director of a very diverse skill set of people that provide services. That's in direct reaction to the monetary situation that both state, federal, and local governments are experiencing. And my last, my only comment would be that from some of my other fellow county zoning administrators, again, echoing Mr. Grunhofer's testimony, the definition of a vacation rental home. One of my fellow zoning administrators discussed the definition of residential property. Is the state going so far as to starting to dictate local density requirements through this language that the author has provided? I guess my other question for the committee to consider is how do we, at the local level, on behalf of neighbors, what is our recourse if there is an operator that is just so egregious that we are spending taxpayer dollars on continually handling nuisances? And I'm not speaking to renters. I don't believe that renters are bad, but everybody has bad behaviors. And at what point, when the operator fails to establish rules and enforce those rules for those renters, what recourse are we left with when the word must is in the law? So those are my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the Mille Lacs County perspective, at least.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you. The question I might have is how does the local subdivision handle a problem like that if it was the owner of the property? Do you have a different standard of how you would react to a less than sociable owner of the property versus someone who's renting?
Actually, no, we wouldn't. Essentially, at that point, it would be up to the property owner. The adjoining property owner is probably to file some sort of civil litigation. However, if we're permitting them through an interim use permit, then we at least have the ability to revoke that permit and prohibit them from operating.
Senator Limmer?
Yeah.
The chair stepped out. He turned the gavel over to me.
So it's not Mr. Chair anymore. Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I guess let's say due to the nature of it being a vacation home, you might have some people that are a little less inhibited at a vacation weekend,
yep,
versus their own backyard and where they live.
Correct.
So they sit around the fire pit and they go a little later into the night than what you'd expect. And I've heard things that maybe they might be, you know, drinking other beverages than what they might do inside their house. And so they get a little loud and obnoxious. Mm-hmm. At least in my neighborhood, we call the police on that. Is that a burden for a lake community more so than any other town or any other community, or for that matter, any other lake owner that might be sitting in his own house doing that same behavior?
Ms. McPherson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you're correct that regardless of whether it's a rental or a single-family homeowner enjoying an adult beverage around their fire pit outside and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and they're getting loud and obnoxious, I think in both cases you would have the same recourse. You would call the sheriff's office. I think if Stearns County's ordinance, I believe, has some quiet hour requirements. Mille Lacs County chose not to impose those because of the very comment that you make, Senator Limmer, that it is the responsibility of the sheriff to respond to those. Now, if you take it to Mr. Grunhofer's example and you have a corporation who might buy 6 or 7 single-family homes, 55-foot-wide lake lots, and you have 6 or 7 in a neighborhood of 14 homes, and every one of those homes has that same thing happen on the same night, now you're talking a significant public safety impact potentially, and a diversion of sheriff's officers to the same neighborhood. Does that happen in a more densely populated urban community? Potentially, but many of those police departments likely have more staff to address that issue.
Senator Kielash?
Yes, that kind of addresses the point I was going to make, and that is, do you know how much the population of Mille Lacs County grows during the summer tourist season, and are you staffed for law enforcement for the winter months or for the summer months? And so therefore, I mean, we're adding more folks, or how is that working for the county?
That's a question that I can't specifically answer. That really, that staffing issue falls to the sheriff's office, and I know from a zoning standpoint, we don't upstaff or downstaff for the seasonal issue. I think on average, you know, I'm not even going to speak to what the staffing levels are because it's not an area that I can speak intelligently to. It would be something I would be happy to contact our sheriff and ask him if he does upstaff for the seasonal changes. We are blessed, however, that we have a big lake with lots of good ice fishing, so maybe there isn't a change in staffing.
Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, Senator Chamberlain, would this legislation in any way prohibit a concerned group of citizens from creating an association with its own governing ordinances regarding some of these issues?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, this legislation is not intended to prohibit citizens from organizing or petitioning the council or the commissioners to address a problem in the community. We're simply asking the communities in this legislation to say you can't prohibit this enterprise, and then we're giving them some leeway to regulate, to license, register, and regulate these homes as they would anybody else. I don't know if that helps out.
Madam Chair and members, if I may, again, Bill Griffith testifying for the association.
Mr. Griffith.
Thank you. This would not affect, for instance, existing covenants that are of record that prevent rental. That's in the nature of a contract between two parties filed of record against the property. All those covenants in a subdivision or an association would still be effective because this is addressing zoning exclusively. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Are there any other testifiers? I see somebody else at the table.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and I join with my colleagues in opposition to this bill. I think the key is to look at the difference. You know, yes, there are mitigating factors that can be done through licensing, but the difference between the zoning and the licensing that's been discussed is one is saying the use is allowed, now figure out how to make it work, versus deciding is it a compatible use in that particular neighborhood. And that's what you're eroding with this bill, is saying we're telling you what the use will be. We're telling you you don't have that control anymore. You can mitigate to an extent, but you're being preempted. And I think that's just a very dangerous slope to go down, because once you grant it to one group, you can imagine who's going to be back, you know, later this session, next session, saying, well, we're not that much different. We want another preemption. We want another preemption. You know, if you're going to allow these uses, it's just a very slippery slope to go down. To tell local governments, we're going to give you zoning authority, but we don't really mean it because we're going to dictate to you the uses that are or are not allowed. And so with that, I'll simply stand for questions. Oh, I'm sorry. I do want to add one other point that I've a brief discussion I've had with one of the proponents of the bill, and that is the issue of for communities that impose lodging taxes, do we now consider these rentals for lodging tax purposes or not? And I think that's unclear. They did indicate they're willing to work with us on that, but it is an issue that just says, you know, this bill has no definition. It raises a lot of questions. It was dropped late last week, heard today, and I understand the process with deadlines and everything. But there are a number of questions that remain with this bill that two of us would say it's not ready. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Are there any questions? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am concerned about an issue that has been brought up already about the definition of vacation rental. And I'm just curious if there's any in any other statute that it would be. And it seems a little premature that this is a bill about vacation rental if we don't have a definition. So I'm wondering, you know, if we have any idea of what that would say and what we could do about that. I don't know if we lay a bill over just to get a definition, because it appears to be a pretty prominent part of this bill.
Mr. Griffith?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, thank you. I appreciate that. When we, again, we took a fairly simple approach when working with the author on this amendment. One of the things we did in deciding whether to define vacation rental is, if you all would just Google or Wikipedia vacation rental, you'll find a very succinct definition. And so we thought, rather than having this kind of concern, that we would use something that is commonly understood as a short-term rental of property. And it's you know, we can define it if, and certainly be willing to talk to the League and others about defining it. But if you all would, after the hearing, just take that exercise for a few minutes and look on Wikipedia, there's a very succinct definition. And then if you Google the term vacation rental, single-family vacation rental or vacation rental homes, you also see that it's been addressed in a number of places. So certainly we're open to further defining the use, but again, we didn't want to jump in and start drawing lines if it's unnecessary.
Mr. Sula?
Madam Chair, one of the issues that that does raise is when you stress the fact that this is meant to be short-term, constant turnover rentals. Getting back to the enforcement situation, when you've got a single family owner and there's a problem, generally speaking, if that's addressed, you've got a one-time issue. When you have the constant turnover, that could become a nightly issue, which then raises more questions about law enforcement, prosecutor times, you know, and the efforts that is an ongoing problem because you've got constant turnover versus a one-time problem with the owner, which gets back to that's a difference in use between I live here, this is my home, versus I'm renting it. So just one other distinction that makes the difference between the need to zone versus the need to license.
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think that generally state statute references Googling or Wikipedia, but so I would suggest that still needs to be worked out.
We'll,
if you think
too,
about in terms of short-term rental, it could be either it's because there's a new renter coming in each night for 365 nights a year, or it could be short-term rental. If that's not defined in statute, does that mean there's one other renter renting the home for, you know, 50 weeks out of the year? So I really think that this bill is, I appreciate what you're trying to do here, Senator Chamberlain, but I think if we pass this without addressing some of these real legitimate concerns, it's just going to create more problems for us down the road in terms of what this means. And I'm particularly concerned, and I apologize I came in late, but the disparities this will create between our bed and breakfast and other facilities that are categorized right now as commercial facilities and this, because it seems like it would be a way for someone to get out of some of the regulations if they wanted to. It just seems like it's creating a big loophole in our statute that could create more problems down the road.
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, one of the distinctions that was made earlier is that these are the biggest distinction between this and public lodging is that these are typically private contracts that are entered into between the owner and the renter. They can stipulate anything the contract wants, behavior, conduct, all those sorts of things. And regarding the definition, as we said, our goal here is to get something to stopgap it, but we have some time. We can get a definition worked out, perhaps with the interested parties.
Mr. Olson. Carl. Do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members. I think our new Senator McGuire had a question first. I'm happy to defer to her on her first day
Senator
here.
Senator McGuire.
you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chair, I'm just following up on a comment that Senator Sieben made about bed and breakfast, and I'm struck by the fact that I have some bed and breakfast in my district, and I'm just wondering, I know they went through a lot of regulations to become that, and so I'm curious if they would just call it a each-night rental, that they would have not had to go through all of those. And so I'm worried that I might hear from them, like, oh, no, why did we have to go through all of that? Without, now that you're passing this, I mean, we don't have to do all of that. So I'm just bringing that up as a concern.
Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, again, these are not public places that you can simply walk up to, open the door, go in and sit down and have a beer at the kitchen table with anybody. These are single family or, in case, you know, maybe a condo or townhome. Again, these are private contracts, individual homes, not public facilities, as it were, and they're managed and operated by, in some cases, by businesses, in a lot of cases, by individuals, you, me, your neighbors, and it's simply free enterprise is a great way of, competition-free enterprise is a great way of regulating the ownership of these properties. And if there was a recurring problem, I might say that if you issue the license and register these businesses and these homes, and there's continuing problems, you yank the license and remove their right to operate that particular facility.
Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is an association of family-owned resort properties throughout Minnesota, although principally in northern Minnesota. It's a group I've represented since 1996, and vacation home rentals is a frequent topic at our association meetings. I want you to also know that I participated in a vacation rental home task force that was established by the legislature by statute in 2007. And many of the concerns that you're kicking around right now were part of that lengthy debate that we had with that task force. It produced a report, which I think the Explore Minnesota Tourism Office would be happy to provide to the committee, because we did go through those issues of a definition. How should they be regulated? And all of us came at this issue from the understanding that these are valuable properties for Minnesota tourism. We want them to be in use, but we also want to be respectful of neighbors, and we also, quite frankly, have an issue of fairness and balance for other lodging establishments. These vacation rental homes, just so you know, are currently subject to regulation by the Department of Health, and this bill, we think, kind of turns that issue on its head. You know, on the issue of fairness as it relates to existing lodging properties, you'd be surprised to know the lengthy amount of effort that resorts and lodging properties go through to become regulated so that they are safe and open and available for public use. None of that would apply to these facilities as we read this bill. And we did not, we do not now, or we didn't during that, task force process come at this from a zoning free-for-all. It's my property. I should be able to use it however I want. And we don't view that in any way as being fair or what the current status of the law is. If that were the case, we'd still have people that are dumping raw sewage into the lake. I live in Sherbourne County. It is the third largest mortgage foreclosure county in the state. If we can now turn every foreclosed home into a vacation rental home available for daily, weekly, or monthly rentals, you are absolutely turning that that neighborhood on its head. It's tough in my neighborhood too, but that doesn't mean that I get to put in a Super America on my street corner. Even though it's a residential area. Well, it's my property. I should be able to use it however I want. We think that that is an absolute wrong-headed approach at coming at this very nettlesome problem. And you'll note in the bill, and I know
Mr.
Grunhofer.
Are we talking about the same bill?
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely.
Does this allow Super Americans to go in any house in the state?
This is, Mr. Chairman and members, you hit right on the very heart of the problem. If you look at the bill on lines 1.19, you will see that the only restrictions right now relative to local government relate to building structures. This would be the first time where we are now saying what it regulates right now is you can't prohibit an earth sheltered construction, or you can't prohibit a appropriately manufactured a home, a mobile home or a modular home. Now we are wading into that area on a type of building, and we are imposing on local units of government a specific type of use. The legislature just has not waded into that territory. And you note on page 2 of the bill on the back that on lines 2.30, you'll see that in zoning classes, they are all supposed to be uniform kinds of uses throughout the zoning district. What this bill says is makes it completely inconsistent. This bill says we are going to permit and allow and mandate that a commercial use of this lodging establishment be imposed into a residential district.
Well, Mr. Carlson, I disagree. Use is in this section of law, and it talks about location specific to maps. It isn't just talking about design of a construction project.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you'll have to maybe I'm certainly happy to be educated, but I don't actually see that in there. It talks about specific kinds of uses that should be consistent within a zoning district, and it is our position that while they are important property to use for tourism, we don't think that the legislature imposes on local units of government a mandate that they authorize a specific permitted use within a zoning district. And I can assure you, for the people that have had nuisance rental properties next to their vacation home, this is a significant problem. We heard numerous stories from people who had issues with their neighbors that were not subject to regulation, where there wasn't an ordinance, where there wasn't licensing, that had issues with noise, nuisance, sewer, overutilization of their smallly designed septic systems. This is a much larger issue than simply saying you are a permitted use. And the bill, as we've indicated, or as others have indicated, it lacks definition, it is overly broad, and I would urge caution as you move forward. I disagree with my friend Mr. Griffin, because I think this does have a problem for people who have existing covenants in their property. If I have a statute that says I can rent out my property, even though I may have a restrictive covenant or have signed an association agreement, I'm going to say that statute controls. You can't prevent me from renting that property because I live in one. I have a homeowner association where I live. We're not supposed to have rental use of our property. It's precluded by our homeowner association. But I'm going to say, too bad. I have a statute that says you can't prevent that. That provision in my homeowner association is not in accordance with statute, and I can rent out my property if I choose. I just think there are larger issues at question here, maybe for the Judiciary Committee, on how this impacts common interest communities and the definitions of what a vacation rental home is. Just want you to know that this is not a simple issue. We have had bills here before to provide a definition of vacation rental homes, which have been resisted and opposed by the people that are promoting this very bill. So we're happy to work on it, but this is much bigger than just than the 8 or 9 sentences in this bill that's before you. And I appreciate the time that you're giving to this, Mr. Chairman, but I would certainly urge caution, because this is much broader than what you're anticipating.
Okay, further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Lodging Association and the Minnesota Resorts and Campground Association. And I am new. I don't have the history that Mr. Carlson had. I have been at the association since the first of the year. But our members have been discussing this issue for quite some time, and they have concerns about the argument around a level playing field. Our 900 members are principally small businesses, family-owned. Some of them, they're second, third, in one case, they're fourth generations. The people who own vacation homes, particularly in greater Minnesota, where some of these, but not all of them, would be located, often know the neighbors who own homes, and these are their friends. And it is certainly not our intention to keep them from renting their property, but rather that they do so with similar costs to ours and with a need to follow similar rules and regulations. I am intrigued, however, by the opportunity for our small inns and lodges to dramatically reduce their cost by reclassifying themselves as vacation rentals and avoiding paying the statewide property tax. So I think the fiscal impact for this for our urban members may be positive, while the competitive impact for our greater Minnesota members will be an issue. But I applaud Mr. Swenson for saying their members want to follow the various laws and rules. The Department of Revenue already makes an effort to have the sales tax collected. It's our view that the local tourism promotion taxes also apply. But I join with Mr. Carlson in saying this is not a simple issue. I think the fiscal note, particularly because of the moderately dramatic reduction in the statewide property tax for properties currently operated commercially, that under this scenario could be operated as vacation home rentals, is moderately significant. We've also heard a discussion that these rentals would be on a nightly, weekly, or monthly basis. I don't read anything in the law that would preclude shorter term, hourly, half day, for business meetings or perhaps other less savory uses. There is no full night or full week requirement as we see it for these kind of rentals. And many people would have different definitions of a vacation. So we also urge caution. We would be delighted to work with the author. But we think in our newsletter today, we said that we're all now familiar with the things that can happen very quickly in this modern society. This bill has happened very quickly. And even though it's a long discussed issue, we think the complexity of it, perhaps to lay it over for further consideration, would be good public policy, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion. Mr. Griffin.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I'll be brief. I was asked by the author to address a couple of the comments by the opponents. First of all, this is a very simple bill. And every time we start talking about a parade of horribles, then we can come up with a much longer bill with lots of complicated ways to think about it. The simple approach that we took as an association was to say this is an allowed use in residential zones. The cities, the counties, the state can still regulate just in every other way that they have regulated, okay? Number two is in terms of the complication with the definition, we can certainly work with any of the other parties to define vacation rentals. But the fundamental issue here is for the past couple of years, you heard it from Mr. Carlson, the state has tried to treat vacation rentals as public lodging. It simply is not that. It's a private contract between parties. We don't have public facilities. We're not open to the public. We don't run restaurants. We don't have golf courses. We don't have any of the trappings of public lodging. Even a bed and breakfast is operated by an owner who invites the public into his or her bed and breakfast and is there making meals. None of that occurs in a single-family vacation rental or a multifamily condo. It's simply a private contract between one individual and another. And so much has been made, and there's this huge parade of horribles, and yet this occurs constantly both in this state and in our neighboring state of Wisconsin. The only thing they do in Wisconsin, which we compete with, is collect the sales tax. And our members are already paying the sales tax, as you heard in testimony to the Department of Revenue. So this parade of horribles has not occurred as this industry has gained foot, and owners have been allowed to basically pay their taxes and keep their homes and pay their mortgages. So again, we are happy to work with all of the interested parties that you see here. But one of the reasons this hasn't gone forward in the past two sessions is because legislators like yourself were not willing to adopt the definition that Mr. Carlson suggests and treat us as public lodging. And the last comment I will make is this task force that was convened by Minnesota Tourism was done so before there was any representation of this group of individuals that testified on behalf of the bill. And so we had absolutely no input into the study, and yet the legislature decided not to adopt a definition of public lodging and apply that to vacation rentals. They chose not to 2 years in a row.
Thank you. Does anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 1190?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carlson, or Mr. Carlson.
I'm getting elevated. I'm housebroken, Mr. Chair. You can have the Department of Health come up and ask them, but the definition, which, by the way, was proposed by them, was an effort for them to have clarity in what is a vacation rental home. And you can ask the Department of Health, do you currently license vacation rental homes as lodging establishments? And I feel confident in having you ask them that question because I know the answer. There are many of them right now that are currently licensed and regulated by the Department of Health as a lodging establishment. They fit the definition, and they are licensed currently today by the Department of Health. This, you know, this effort essentially says we don't have to do that anymore. We don't need to license them. And we think when it relates to consumer safety for fire codes, health inspection, food, pools, hot tubs, plumbing, resorters can't even do plumbing on their own property when it's held out for public use. We have to get a plumbing license to do it. None of that would apply to these now permitted facilities. And I would suggest, again, this is the first time, if you read this section, this is the first time that the legislature is wading in and saying that we are now going to establish what a permitted use is within each zoning district within a municipality. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on Senate File 1190. Seeing none, Senator Chamberlain renews his motion that Senate File 1190 as amended be recommended to pass and place on general orders. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 1157. Senator Robley. Senator Robley.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1157 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Transportation Committee, actually.
Senator Robley moves that Senate File 1157 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Transportation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Senator Robley.
To that motion. Members, this bill would actually create a Metropolitan Transportation Board, and the board would take the place of the Metropolitan Council as the designated planning agency for long-range comprehensive transportation planning required by federal law. And we have had a lot of discussion about governance of transit since the Office of the Legislative Auditor put out its report 2 months ago, saying that they believe there's a better method of governing transit. But in the meantime, for quite a long time, there has been a great deal of concern about transportation planning. The system is very convoluted and difficult to follow, and we believe that the way our system in the metropolitan area is currently set up is in violation of federal law. And I have with me the county attorney from Scott County who has reviewed this law extensively and is here to share with us why he believes that our current Transportation Advisory Board does not meet the requirements set forth in federal law as a pass-through. Well, it's actually the Met Council has become the pass-through agency, but why the pass-through agency needs to be devised in a different manner so that we do meet the requirements of federal law. And as you can see in the bill, we actually take out, we believe that elected officials need to comprise this pass-through agency. And so we always like public members, we are eliminating the citizen members on the council, also eliminating the appointment of the chair by the Met Council, and having the board appoint its own chair from among its members. And members, I'd just like you to listen to the compelling case as to why we believe that the current makeup is not meeting federal requirements.
Mr. Chair, I'm John Ulrich. I'm Scott County Commissioner. I've been County Commissioner and on the tab for 10 years.
Mr. Clark.
And I would say during most of those years, the relationship between the tab and the Met Council has been collegial, cooperative, and worked very well together. I would say in the last few years, it hasn't worked as well. Let me give you an example of what has happened most recently with adoption of the Transportation Policy Plan at the end of last year. The Transportation Policy Plan for the metropolitan area, you would think that three things would have happened as the TAB being the designated advisory board for the policy plan.
One is that the plan would be presented in its fullness to the Transportation Advisory Board. Then it would go out for comments, and the Transportation Advisory Board would receive the comments back and be made aware of all the comments that the public had made about the policy plan, and then we'd see those comments and then in their fullness as well. And then finally, a third meeting where the Met Council would respond to the comments and how their plan changed in response to the comments, and then we would see the final plan as a Transportation Advisory Board to advise the Met Council on the plan. This past year, none of those happened, at least in the sequence in which they should. We never saw the transportation policy plan in its fullness. It never came back with all the comments. We never saw all the comments that were made, nor did we see the comments or the responses that the Met Council had made to the plan. Now, about a month later, after the plan was already adopted, the Met Council came back. I think they were probably trying to cover their bases, and it's kind of like, oh, we better at least tell them what the comments were and how we responded. But that was after the plan had been passed by the Met Council, and we did not get to see those. In fact, I expressed frustration at the TAB saying, how do you expect us to advise when we haven't seen the final plan? And they said, well, if you want to see the final plan, it will be published tomorrow night. And that was after we were expected to vote, after the needed approval. And so we never got to actually even vote on the final plan that was before us, or supposed to be before us, because it really wasn't there before us. And so that's the kind of process we've been experiencing. There's been widespread frustration on the TAB with that process. That's why now, right now, tomorrow, Wednesday, the TAB will be going back through the process and asking process questions. But why has this happened? Why is it devolved into this kind of a process? Partly is because I think that the TAB is not in its right role. Even right now, in its current understanding, some would say we're advisory, and then question why at certain times during the year we asked to formally vote on and amend the TPP, and our vote is needed to amend the TPP when we're just advisory. You know, so it's inconsistent. The TPP, are we advisory, or do we actually have vote to recommend? And so even right now in the current structure, there's a problem. But in regard to the federal law, we don't believe that the TAB fulfills federal law. The appointments that the Met Council makes directly, there's 8 appointments that they make directly. Those are not prescribed in federal law. And the federal law is very specific, very precise on exactly how the TAB must be made up, or the MPO must be made up, and the members that must be on it. And so they're not on there. The chair being appointed by the Met Council, that's not in the law. And then even if we were fully compliant in terms of the members, federal law would say that the TAB is the MPO, not the Met Council. And so that's our problem with the law and how the TAB is being gone over, around, and not being consulted in its current fashion. And I'm going to turn it over now to our County Administrator, Gary Schell.
Mr. Chair, committee members of the committee, we believe that the...
Could you state your name for the tape?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Gary Shelton, I'm the Scott County Administrator.
Thank you.
We believe that the legislation before you today in Senate File 1157 really does constitute a legitimate and very reasoned approach to correcting an issue that we see with respect to the intent of the federal legislation and the federal regulations, which would require that local elected officials play a key role, play the key role in how transportation policy and transportation dollars, federal dollars in particular, are spent within a planning organization or within a metropolitan area. By establishing the TAB, which was created as an advisory body to try and conform to federal law, but we believe does not, by making the TAB the actual MPO, this would bring the metropolitan area's MPO into the same conformance with federal law that every other MPO within the state of Minnesota currently has. So if you look at the MPOs in Minnesota, and I believe there are either 6 or 7 of them total, none of them are fashioned in the way that the metropolitan MPO is fashioned. They all are fashioned more along the lines of what's being proposed in this legislation in conformance to federal law. And the same would be true if you look nationally. There is no MPO anywhere in the nation that discards and discounts the role that local elected officials should play. And so we believe that this simply codifies the appropriate role of the local elected officials as federal regulations would require. And I would ask our county attorney, Pat Siliberto, if he wanted to comment in terms of the actual regulations themselves.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I believe that...
Could you state your name for the tape?
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Pat Siliberto, Scott County Attorney.
Thank you.
Thank you. I believe that Commissioner Ulrich and County Administrator Shelton have fairly stated it. And what I'd like to do is simply say that in our review of federal law, we have approached both the Met Council as well as Federal Highway Administration. And frankly, I wasn't surprised to get a letter back from the Federal Highway Administration saying that they believe it's being followed correctly. I say I'm not surprised because it hasn't been done correctly under federal law for years. But what I would rather do, since it's been fairly stated what the issues are by Commissioner Ulrich and Mr. Shelton, I'd like to ask you if you have any questions of me concerning the federal law.
Okay. Senator Kalish.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Siliberto. So what you're saying is that we're not in compliance with federal law, but the federal highway department or transportation department said we are in compliance. So because your opinion says that doesn't change the fact that the federal government has said we are in compliance. And so, I mean, you're kind of, it seems like you're in conflict with what's already been approved. And I'm not familiar with how long this current administration has been going on, but it sounds like it's been several years. Do you know when it was established?
I think we've been doing it wrong, Senator, for about 40 years.
Oh, so. Even though the department says we're doing it right. So one of the things I'm concerned about is creating another bureaucracy that that's doing the same thing we've already been doing and actually been doing quite well and, for a long time. And one of the things about the Met Council, it looks over things beyond transportation that are also affecting the regionally. So I guess I'm not sure where the need is other than you'd like to see the members change on the board. And you can answer that, I guess.
Mr. Siliberto?
Senator, what I'd like to say in response to that is we would like to see the federal law followed. And at present, and I realize you use the term opinion, and, of course, we're stating what we believe is correct. However, I think the true issue here is concerning the fact that the Met Council does not constitute a metropolitan organization for transportation management under federal law. That's the core of it here. And you are absolutely correct that the issues that are being discussed concerning the Met Council are far-ranging right now. But transportation is vital, and we believe that it needs to be addressed now.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, and to the councilman, it seems to me that your issue with how the Met Council was doing business was last year, and they are under new management. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't be wiser just to give them a chance to do things the right way, according to the way it had been previously when you were satisfied with them.
Mr. Siliberto.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that it's a top management issue. Deeper into the organization and how staff operate and how the relationship between staff and elected officials is carried on.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Kalish.
But isn't staff run by the management of the Met Council? I mean, if there's new management, the staff are going to follow directions from management, so they should be more cooperative.
That's been my question as well.
Mm-hmm. New management, give them a chance.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand the purpose of this more, and perhaps, Senator Roebling, you could just help elaborate on, I understand that the county that you represent believes that they're in violation of federal law, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on, more on, you know, changing the makeup of this. What will the end result be, in your opinion, that will help make the TAB or this new transportation board a more efficient or better run agency?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I envision that the TAB would not just be advisory any longer. It would be the board that actually would have final say over the planning and the granting of federal monies, the pass-through agency, that it would become the agency that would do that, it would become the board that would do it. And it seems to me that in other parts of the state, that is what happens, that they have a group of local elected officials that serve that role. But in the metropolitan area, we have a TAB, but then it goes one more level. It just gets it more complicated. It goes to the Met Council. And it's questionable if the TAB is actually made up of is properly constituted. There are a majority of elected officials on the TAB, but then there's a majority of, I mean, then there's a large group of non-elected officials. I think there's about 32, 33, 34 people on the TAB. I think 17 of them are elected.
Okay.
And what we're saying is we believe that a much higher percentage of them should be elected, and that the elected officials should really have the final say, because we believe that's what is required by the federal law and is practiced in other communities throughout the country.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about the legislative auditor's recommendation to make some of the to replace some of members on the TAB with elected officials? I mean, why not just look at what the legislative auditor has done instead of going to a model like this where it's still a little bit unclear?
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, that's another way to look at it. We are doing that. We are replacing non-elected members with elected. We want elected members. It is getting there. I don't know. The auditor was recommending something similar to this, that we put the elected officials basically in control of this. And as we know, the Met Council is not elected. And so we're just trying to keep that decision-making at a level where there are elected officials involved.
And then, Mr. Chair, one last question. On lines 1.14, it says that the board shall assure administration and coordination of transit planning. Why is it not transportation planning?
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair. And Senator Sieben, that's a very good catch. I don't know why it says that. I would think it should be transportation planning for the whole community.
Commissioner Ulrich, did you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's a mistake. That will be changed to transportation.
Okay.
Maybe it should be amended right now.
Maybe we could.
Take out the stricken language and reinsert it and take out the new language.
On page 1, line 14, reinstate transportation and delete transit.
Senator Roebling moves that amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Senator Kalish?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, do we have a fiscal note on this because of the changing responsibilities, holding, creating a new board with staff, et cetera? And I realize some of it could be absorbed, but it still requires some kind of planning, restructuring of offices, all the rest of it to make this happen. So I'm guessing there should be a pretty significant fiscal note on this in order to make this happen.
Senator Kalish, I understand that we do have some preliminary numbers, but that the final ones wouldn't be ready until this is going to transportation. Okay. But we could someone discuss that briefly?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I do understand that there is a fiscal note being prepared. However, I do believe that if this work is going to be done somewhere, it is currently being funded elsewhere, and certainly that funding could be transferred, and I don't think that there should be a large fiscal note associated with that transfer. It would be taking resources from one entity and giving it to another.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I think my point, Senator Roebling, was on the transition, that things don't happen by themselves, and people don't, we don't have a bunch of people standing around at the Met Council able to coordinate and administer a transition as to whose duties are what, and providing, if not the same staff, but coordinating all of that. And I imagine they all would like to be in the same location for the transit board rather than scattered throughout the Met Council's facilities.
Well, we may have, Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, we may have a difference of opinion on that, whether or not that those resources would be available. But I think that we would be addressing that in transportation and certainly in the Finance Committee.
Senator Kalish, maybe they could use some of that $800 million, something like this. But
$800 million from where?
They're $800 million they spent. Fiscal staff, did you want to comment?
Mr. Chair and members, what I have is a preliminary fiscal note that's not completed and the system has not been signed off by MMB, but the numbers have been provided by Metropolitan Council, and they can certainly comment on these. If you'd like to hear it, I can tell you what's in the fiscal note as is.
Would you please?
What's assumed is that $3.6 million in federal planning funds, which Met Council receives annually for these purposes, would still be available, but they do require a 20% local match or $900,000, which is not accounted for in the language of the bill and comes out of Met Council's budget as is. A number is not put on, but there is language saying that the Metropolitan Council provides some gratis or in-kind staff support to the TAB, and that a new independent transportation board would need to hire for its own support services and need to have funds from some source to cover such expenses.
Thank you. Any further, Senator McGuire?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new to the committee. Is it procedure that we would proceed without fiscal notes on bills, or how? I'm just curious how that goes, because are we in a big hurry to do this without a fiscal note? I'm just curious about that.
Senator McGuire, this
we're
is going
in a big
to
hurry, so we don't need to know how much things cost. Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, Senator.
Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, this is strictly a policy committee, and so the Transportation Committee does have jurisdiction over finance and policy, and so I think that would be the appropriate place to address it.
Okay, so we don't.
But Senator McGuire, I think it's still appropriate to talk about it. We have a preliminary, so I think we have a general idea of the cost for our purposes here.
Thank you for that. And then I have one more.
Senator McGuire.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate that clarification for my benefit. It appears as though now the Transportation Board is created. So then are they the ultimate authority? Will that be then need to be approved by the Met Council, the decisions that they make? Will it? Who has ultimate approval authority for this transportation planning, because we've looks like we've taken the Met Council out of it. I'm just curious if I'm reading this correctly.
Mr. Sheldon.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think there's a misconception here that this is creating something that doesn't already exist. Okay. There already exists in statute a Transportation Advisory Board. So this board isn't being created by this legislation. It's simply being modified by this legislation. I'm surprised to hear that there's this fiscal note, because absolutely nothing that is not already being done today would be different. The only thing this does by policy, this is a policy bill, is it changes the authority, the heart of your very question, it changes the authority for the final approval of the transportation plan and funding from the Metropolitan Council, which is entirely appointed, to the Transportation Advisory Board, which already exists. So it really flips the roles from the Transportation Advisory Board being advisory to being the primary decider. And so it does change the structure of the Transportation Advisory Board, the strikeouts in there, in that it removes from the Transportation Advisory Board all those folks who are appointed by the Metropolitan Council to that particular board. And it solidifies the role of local elected officials in making those decisions. But this isn't intended, it wasn't intended to create a whole separate body, a whole separate bureaucracy. It was intended to take the existing. It was meant to be a reasonable approach to take what already exists in statute, and simply change the authority for who makes the final decision from an appointed body to an elected body.
Mm-hmm. If I could, one more follow-up.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then we're taking away responsibility from the Met Council, in effect, right? Because they, if, as I understand what the Met Council does, they do like three major things. So we're taking away one of the major things that the Met Council would do. If this becomes the ultimate decision-making body, then the Met Council would not have responsibility for this part of their planning. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Sheldon.
Mr. Chair, Senator, they would not have the final responsibility for passage of a TPP. That rather, it literally flips the role. So you could say it takes away their responsibility. I think more it takes away their authority. I think they would still, because of their role in planning, they have a role in a variety of other issues within the metropolitan area. But in terms of transportation, it would take away their authority to be the final approver of a plan. And I'm assuming they would still participate in that process.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. What about, I understand Scott County is in favor of this. What about other counties within the Metropolitan Council area? Have you reached out to them, and do you know, Senator Roebling, if they're in support of this change?
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I don't know. Mr. Shelton has a response.
Mr. Sheldon.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we've not asked other counties at this point to support this particular legislation. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that the Association of Minnesota Counties of District 10 have met on this issue in particular, and do believe that governance is a key problem with the current Metropolitan Council. But we've not asked for their support at this point or discussed this specific legislation with them.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that you're bringing this discussion forward. I haven't heard from my particular counties and am reluctant to support the bill at this point without their without having the counties that I represent have taken a look at this. So.
Senator Kalish.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, is there someone from the Met Council that can comment on this?
Yeah, we were anticipating they'd want to testify when we got to, I think they might be opposed to the. Mr. Sheldon.
Yeah.
If you'd like.
Sit down. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Appreciate the opportunity to discuss this bill. And Senator Vandiver, you're correct. The council does not support this bill. I will tell you, however, we just heard this bill over in the House, and the bill was laid over. And one of the reasons why that occurred, I believe, is because
we felt the intention of the bill in the House was to begin the conversation, and I was hoping that that may be the same case with this bill here in the Senate, because I understand that there were some issues with Scott County and how the Metropolitan Council went about adopting the transportation policy plan last fall. However, we do not believe, as the county attorney stated, that we move forward under an illegal process, and we actually have a letter from the Federal Highway Administration, FHWA, in response to an inquiry that that Scott County had asked them to review the process of the MPO status of the council and how we move forward with the transportation policy plan. And they sent back a letter specifically stating that since 1973, I'll just read you the quick this section here. The Federal Highway Administration said that they consulted with their Office of Chief Counsel and their headquarters planning staff to ensure that they thoroughly vetted the issue that Scott County raised regarding the MPO status of the council in our work with the TAB. And it says the FHWA has concluded that the 1973 designation of the Met Council as the MPO for the Twin Cities by then Governor Anderson was in conformance with both law and regulations, and that the existing structure remains in compliance. And this letter was sent on January 13th of 2011. And Mr. Chair and members, I would really like to take up Senator Kielash's comments about maybe working with the administration and having a conversation with the council, and we'd like to have that conversation with both Chair Roebling and the members from Scott County and the other counties. And there was a letter that was sent, I believe last October, early November, to Scott County from then Met Council Chair Peter Bell that said that they'd like to look at the structure and the role of the TAB along with the council moving forward when we adopt the transportation policy plans. And I think that now would be an excellent time to do that. I know that there are some issues with how things worked and how Scott County viewed the adoption process of the transportation policy plan. I can only tell you that it was held in a formal process that the FHWA has said was compliant. And that being said, we would still like to have that conversation, because we believe that this bill right now is a step back from what where we need to go, and especially since the legislative auditor, which we heard from them, has said what they'd like to look at for transit governance in the region. We do believe that this is adding an additional layer, and when we talk about the fiscal impact, is as Ms. Boyd said, that there is a $900,000 local match. That local match comes from motor vehicle sales tax right now. And if you create a new board, and we can certainly talk about this in the Transportation Committee, but there is an impact on the transit and transportation, or transit budget, at least for the Metropolitan Council. So we would like to continue that conversation. I hope that this can be considered a conversation starter rather than a moving forward with the bill as it stands. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Roebling, you had a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we're not creating a new board. We're just giving the board more authority, and we believe that they should be the ones with the authority, because they're the ones with the elected officials, and that's what this is about, is who gets the final authority in approving these plans, and we believe it should be a board with elected officials, and that's all this is about.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shutton, could you tell me, Without the Transit Advisory Board, could the Metropolitan Council function as the region's MPO in its current state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm going to ask Arlene McCarthy to come speak to this. She can speak with much more authority on that question than I can. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Arlene McCarthy with the Met Council. No, the answer to your question, Senator, is that no, the Met Council alone could not meet the federal requirements as the MPO, and that's because there does need, by federal law, to be elected some elected officials.
Ms. McCarthy, could you switch that off and trade mics? I think that one does that all the time.
Oh, thank you. Is that any better? Oh.
Mr. Chair, is that better?
Much better.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll just start over then again. Arlene McCarthy with the Met Council. In response to Senator Cruz's question, no, the Metropolitan Council alone would not meet the federal requirements because, as has been stated, federal requirements are that there be some elected officials on the board. So it is the Met Council and the Transportation Advisory Board, or TAB, together that meet the federal requirements for the Metropolitan Planning Organization, or the MPO.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. McCarthy, thank you for that. So would it be safe to assume then that if the FHWA made that analysis, that they were counting on that Transportation Advisory Board as that piece, and that essentially what we're doing is we're allowing them to function kind of in name only without allowing them to have the authority that the FHWA would possibly intend them to have as an MPO?
Ms. McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz. The federal requirements call for the local governance to create its process. And we have done that here in this region through a series of documents. Most recently, we created a memorandum of understanding that and that was, I believe, adopted in 2008. The federal process kind of required an update, I believe, of all MPOs at that time. So that's why we had the timing on that. So an MOU was created. It went through the process of TAB approval and ultimately and FHW approval ultimately was executed between the Met Council and MnDOT because the money for MPOs flows through the Department of Transportation to the Met Council. So there's also a MnDOT role in this. And in that process, we laid out the roles and responsibilities of the Metropolitan Council and the TAB. For example, on planning documents, the TAB's role is to review, comment, recommend to the Metropolitan Council, but the Metropolitan Council adopts. When it comes to some of the federal funding that comes to the council, then it's TAB, per this MOU, that has the authority. And actually, and this is kind of the heart of where the local elected officials come in, is on the decision of the funding. And it's actually the TAB that runs the process, runs the what we call the regional solicitation. And the TAB selects the projects and the funding to each of those projects, and the council concurs. So that's, in that part, TAB does have the ultimate authority and the council concurs. So those roles and relationships have been laid out in the past, and that's what has been followed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCarthy, could the Metropolitan Council choose not to concur as an appointed body versus an elected body? Could they choose to turn down those recommendations?
Ms. McCarthy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, yes, when TAB makes a recommendation on funding of projects, when it selects the funding of projects, it comes to the Met Council, and the Met Council has two choices. The Met Council can either concur with TAB's recommendations or send back. The council cannot change. So then in that case, it would go back to TAB, and I'm sure there would be discussion. But ultimately, it is TAB that approves those funding decisions, and the council concurs in order for the funding to move forward.
Members, we are to adjourn at 3 o'clock. So,
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Kalish,
Senator Kalish, there's a few more questions. If you'd like to lay it over till next week, I don't know if there's a rush on this, but a couple of questions: does the current system work the way it was intended, or I'm trying to figure out what problem we're trying to solve here, other than the fact that somebody's complaining about the structure, but I haven't heard that it's been a problem with the current structure at this point, to one extent or the other. So either Senator Roebling or what's your name?
Mr. Chair, that's why I started out with the process that involved the adoption of the last TPP. Okay. We are meant to advise in everybody's mind. In other words, no one that questions that. The question last year when we'd adopt that TPP, did we have any meaningful opportunity to advise? And I'd say no. If we didn't see the plan, we didn't see the comments, and we didn't see the response to the comments, and we didn't see the final plan, what opportunity to advise is that? We did finally, after a month after the plan was approved, they came back and presented the comments and the response to the comments, but that's kind of like too late.
If I might also add, Mr. Chair,
Senator
to that.
Senator Roebling, it's 3 o'clock. Do we, we could take this Wednesday or next Monday, or sorry, the 27th, if you'd like. I think we're supposed to adjourn at 3, and I think it's 3. Would that be all right? We'll take it up first, Bill, and vote on it on next Wednesday. Would that be all right?
It's okay with me, but it's much more difficult for my testifiers probably, especially since we have a long journey to go before this would even hit the floor. I know it goes to transportation and then goes to finance. So I don't know.
Well, I'm ready to vote on it, but members, are there? Senator?
Yeah, Mr. Peterson. Chair, members, I'm ready to vote as well. I mean, we use this process in central Minnesota through an area planning organization. I see this bill as a way to streamline the decision-making process related to transportation. I appreciate the county wanting to handle it this way that rather than through a lawsuit, and I'm ready to vote on it as well. So
I have a clarifying question. So this affects all the counties, though. This affects Ramsey County and all of that also, right? So this affects my county. Do we know how these other counties feel? I know we already sort of asked that, but do we know?
Been out for, when was it introduced?
I imagine about 10 days ago, Mr. Chair. I can't remember for sure.
It's been on the agenda for a few days, so I think people know about it if they wanted to be here.
Mr. Chair, really the testimony hasn't been completed. I mean, there's questions. We had a response from the Met Council ready to go, and, you know, this isn't something that this current system's been in place for 38-plus years. Do we have to do it today just to move it along when we actually have a lot of questions that need to get answered and testimony, I think, from other counties that might want to step in here?
This is pretty dramatic.
You know, 3 o'clock has come and gone, and we're supposed to be done with this committee, Mr. Chair.
I will move to lay it on the table on the condition that we do get a hearing on it next Wednesday. And in the meantime, members can talk to their appropriate county officials, city officials, whatever they need to do to see if they're going to have a problem with it. So, Mr. Chair, I move to lay it on the table.
Will be the first bill up. Actually, we'll just lay over. How about if we just lay it over until the next meeting? Then we don't have to vote to get it off the table, I think. Senate File 1157 is laid over. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.